You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Industries and institutions from health to media have transformed dramatically over the past century. New inventions, economic growth, the internet have changed our world in immeasurable ways.
In spite of all that change, one key institution has remained largely unchanged, our higher education system. According to education policy expert Kevin Carey, our universities in a lot of ways today look like they did 100 years ago. But he says that's about to change.
Exploding costs, record-breaking debt, and questions over the actual outcomes of higher education are forcing the industry to reinvent itself, and to do so using the tools that other industries have been embracing for years, things like the internet, big data, and crowdsourcing.
Kevin Carey joins us now. He's director of the Education Policy Program at the New America Foundation. His new book is called The End of College, Creating the Future of Learning and the University of Everywhere. Kevin, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here.
Well, the basics. Your premise is our college system as it stands is deeply flawed. Big picture, how so?
Well, the cost of going to higher education has increased enormously over the last three decades to the point where for a lot of middle-class families, it's become an immense financial burden just to send a couple of kids to a good college and get them through. At the same time, there's a lot of new research that suggests that many students, including those who graduate, really aren't learning that much in our colleges and universities, which don't challenge them with rigorous curriculum or even really pay enough attention to how much they're learning while they're there. Colleges and universities really have not changed in any fundamental way since their basic design, as we know it now, was created in the late 19th century. They've used information technology to kind of sustain themselves but not really transform themselves. I think that the long-term cost problem in higher education, which is both a function of colleges being inefficient but also a function of state governments pulling money out of higher education, is really moving us toward a breaking point where we're going to have to come up with new organizational models that use information technology to provide a great education to all kinds of students, but not break the bank at the same time.
We'll get into how those models can change in a bit. I want to get into some of the history you cover. You go back about 1,000 years. For now, let's go back about 100. And you say at the inception of the modern era of college, there were three alternate viewpoints. Our universities, our colleges, be in effect workplace training, something to benefit the economy, or they could be research institutions, or they could be liberal arts colleges. And faced with that decision, the answer is yeah, sure, all of those. So that's one of the fundamental flaws you see with what's happened since.
I think that's right. And to be clear, that's not a thesis that I developed originally for this book. It was actually first put forth in a book by the higher education historian Lawrence Veazey, in a book that he wrote 50 years ago. Lawrence Veazey actually worked at the University of Wisconsin-Madison for a couple of years early in his career before going out to UC Santa Cruz, where he did most of his work. But exactly right. There really was this great debate after the Civil War, where some people said we should be training people for jobs, and some people said, no, we should be like the German research university, and some people said, no, it's really important to embrace the liberal arts education ideals. We kind of scrunched all three of those things into one institution with some really strange results. It's very odd, I think, that we have a higher education system in which the highest credential, the PhD, is one that does not require people to have any training in pedagogy or teaching methods. Particularly at research universities, we promote and pay professors almost entirely by their prowess as scholars, not their prowess as teachers. Colleges like to pretend that those two things go together, but they really don't in many cases. Teaching is sacrificed in favor of research, and I think students really suffer as a consequence.
Well, and that brings me to a point you touched on right at the outset there. We're paying a lot for our universities, but students maybe not learning that much. Do we have consistent ways of knowing what students learn in their 4 or 5 or 6 year journey to a bachelor's degree?
We really don't. We just kind of trust that colleges are doing the right thing. And remarkably, given the number of very, very smart researchers who live and work on college campuses, there's very little solid empirical evidence that would actually meet the standards that scholars hold themselves to when it comes to publishing that would allow a particular university to make any kind of solid claims about how much students are actually learning between the time that they arrive and the time that they leave. And it's this funny thing when colleges say we've raised our academic standards, what they often mean is we've raised our entrance standards. Our median SAT score has gone up. But that's a measure of how smart students were when they arrived, not how much they learned while they were there.
And another measure that you write about, and this is kind of shocking in some ways, is one way that colleges signal their quality and the rigorous standards is by increasing tuition.
And this is really a consequence of not having any information about quality. If you want to have a market that functions on a sense of value, you need to know both price and quality so you can put the two things together, because that's all value is, quality divided by price. If we don't know what quality is, then price and quality become confused with one another. And we see that a lot, particularly in the upper echelons of higher education, where a lot of institutions become elite by charging elite prices. There's almost this assumption that if you charge the same tuition as Harvard, you must be as good at Harvard. That's been a way that a lot of colleges have sort of climbed the status ladder and used that money to build fancy gyms and nicer facilities and recruit certain kinds of faculty, but it's the parents and students that really get left with the bill, and increasingly that bill is being expressed in terms of debt. We now have over $1.2 trillion in outstanding student loan debt in America, more even than we have in credit card debt.
We're talking to Kevin Carey from the New America Foundation about the future of higher education and his new book, The End of College. Kevin, let's start getting into solutions. One area that you point to as bearing a lot of potential for change, for improvement, is the use of online education, online technology. Where do you see the best hopes for improvement?
Yeah, we live in a kind of an amazing time where you can now log on to your computer and take full, complete classes from some of the best universities in the world, including Harvard and MIT. I actually took an entire MIT genetics class in writing the book. This is exactly the same class that MIT offers to its own freshmen. Same lectures, same problem sets, same exams, same grades. There were 100 people in Cambridge, Massachusetts taking this class, and about 10,000 people around the world taking it online. People as young as 13 years old, as old as 85, from almost every nation on earth. It didn't cost any of us a dollar. It was offered completely free through the edX online platform. Now, to be clear, I don't see the future of higher education for most people as being purely online. I think people will still want to live and learn with other people. For certain kinds of people, college isn't just about taking classes. It's also a coming-of-age experience where you experience extracurriculars and you're exposed to diverse viewpoints. All these things that many of our fondest memories of going to college, if we were lucky to go to college. My argument is that you can do both at the same time, however. You can create places that provide that coming-of-age experience, that socialization, that provide face-to-face contact with other students and people. But if you use all of the tremendous new resources that are now available and will become available in the future educationally, you can build institutions that aren't nearly as expensive or elaborate as the ones that we have now and actually provide a better education.
And another idea you mentioned is extending your college career basically through your lifetime. I think you use the analogy of a cathedral. It's not a place you go to for 4 years and you're done. You continue your university education through your life. How would that work?
People need to learn throughout their lives. They want to learn throughout their lives. We don't live in a world where you train for a certain job and then just have that job for 20 or 30 or 40 years. People constantly need to be keeping up with a very fast-changing world around them. And college is also not just about, of course, having skills for employment. It's also about learning to be a better person, learning to live a more enlightened life. One of the reasons that I think a lot of colleges have fallen down in providing access to a really good liberal arts education is that I don't think that you can learn all you need to know from a liberal arts standpoint in as short as 4 years. 4 years is the number that we came up with a long time ago, and it's very expensive to engage in higher education, traditionally speaking. So I think that in the future, education and our relationship with colleges and educational organizations will be more lifelong, maybe a little bit closer to our relationship with organizations of faith. So enough of a financial and time commitment that you're engaged with it maybe once a week for a few hours, maybe more than that, but not so much that you can't also have a family and a job and a life at the same time.
We're talking to Kevin Carey, author of The End of College, about how technology and costs are changing higher education in the United States.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're in college now, or maybe your child is, do you think higher education is working the way it should? What problems do you see with higher education in the U.S., and what is working well? How would you change things, and what role do you see for technology? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about the future of higher education with Kevin Carey, director of the Education Policy Program at the New America Foundation.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've had a college experience recently, how'd it work for you? If you could redesign it, what would you do differently? Have you taken an online course, either all by itself or as part of your education? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller now. We've got Dan with us in Wakefield, Michigan. Dan, hi.
Hello, how's everybody?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Dan?
Well, I teach at a community college in the Western Upper Peninsula, and I'm in my 30th year, but I taught high school for 22 years. In order to teach high school, I had to be highly qualified and certified. I'm amazed at the junior college level and at universities, teachers don't need certification, almost as if anybody can teach. And I do think there are some good teachers without certification, but it does water down the requirements, and it seems opposite. If K-12 has to be, why not higher ed?
Dan, thanks for the call. Kevin, what do you think of that?
Yeah, it is a kind of a strange situation. There's actually quite a bit of curricular overlap between the latter years of high school and the first couple of years of college, particularly in community colleges. So the idea that our collective sense of what the qualifications are to be good at that job suddenly changes radically when students go from being 18 years old to 19 years old is odd. And it's just kind of historical happenstance that just is sort of where the line was drawn. And it sort of shows how in some ways certain kinds of ideas and value systems that might kind of have made sense for very elite research universities have filtered down all throughout our higher education system. And so we have community colleges where, the professors there are not teaching a couple of classes and spending all the time in the laboratory. They're often teaching five whole classes a semester. Their job is almost wholly focused on teaching a very diverse array of students. Some of them are very good, but they do come from different kinds of backgrounds. Those kind of colleges often don't get the same sort of financial support from governments as more elite institutions. That really is where I think we need to put a lot of our investment and where there are actually a lot of opportunities to wisely integrate information technology into some good community-focused organizations that are already there.
Speaking of investment, before we get back to callers, Kevin, I saw you quoted in the Chronicle of Higher Education the idea being that, well, hey, if you're saying our current college system is obsolete, does that mean the states, the federal government, shouldn't be supporting them as much?
No, exactly the opposite. We need more public support for higher education. The system we have now is really deeply inequitable. We provide far more money to institutions that educate students from wealthier backgrounds, students from higher socioeconomic classes, and we provide less money to institutions that educate first-generation students, low-income students, minority students, immigrant students. That needs to change. That issue is something that needs to happen at the same time that we work to make sure that all of our higher education institutions really do take full advantage of the opportunity to improve themselves and in some ways transform themselves given what is now possible with information technology.
We'll go back to our callers. We've got Marina on the line in Pleasant Prairie. Marina, hi.
Yes. Hello, I have two comments, and I'll listen to your response afterwards. Good afternoon. My first comment has to do with, actually, I was always curious about the origins of higher education, as back in the day when you was basically reserved for your upper class, and the working class usually went into the apprenticeship, okay, and it's almost today, you have, more access to it, but you still have that division because of the boss. The last statement I had to make, I have a daughter that attends UWW. My biggest beef I notice with education is some, say, like this organic chemistry instructor she came from MIT. A lot of times, the unfortunate part is that an educator or a professor, in this case, they don't realize the purpose of education is to teach, is to convey the information.
Gotcha, Marina. I want to jump in and get our guest to respond now, UW-Whitewater. So first, Kevin, class distinctions in modern education.
Well, higher education is all bound up in our ongoing kind of collective debate about class, and I think the caller was exactly right. Higher education used to be much more for the elite, and then in the mid-20th century, sort of starting with the GI Bill and moving through the expansion of a lot of our university and community college systems, we now have a system of mass higher education. Somewhere between 75 and 80% of students who graduate from high school will go into a college of some kind by their mid-20s. We don't have much of a job training system in this country. Higher education is where it happens. In a lot of ways, that's part of the problem. We rely on both financially and institutionally our colleges and universities to, for certain broad parts of the workforce, provide critical training and credentials. But often these are institutions that in some ways either explicitly or implicitly look down on the vocational part of their mission. That vocational is not a word that a lot of colleges even want to associate themselves with, and I think that's too bad. I think good institutions both expose people to the sciences and the humanities, but also provide practical skills that you can use to get a job. And particularly if students are going to walk out into the workforce with debt, as 70% of all students with bachelor's degrees now borrow an average of $30,000, they have to be able to get a good job to pay those loans back.
Talking to Kevin Carey from the New America Foundation about his new book, The End of College. And related to Marina's second point there, we had a comment from Sarah on Facebook. This is Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, a researcher here at UW, guest on the show from time to time. She says, Kevin Carey claims that faculty don't care about teaching, know how to teach or prioritize teaching. What evidence does he have for this? Sounds like he's talking about a small number of faculty at a certain type of university.
Well, I mean, the book actually goes into great length about that. This is an observation that isn't just being made by me now. This has been made almost from the beginning of the design of the system. In, I think, the early 20th century, right around 1901, William James, the famous pragmatist philosopher at Harvard, brother of Henry James, the novelist, wrote a long essay called The PhD Octopus, where he bemoaned the fact that colleges all of a sudden had decided that you needed to have a PhD in order to teach in the classroom, even though the things that you did to get a PhD had really nothing to do with whether or not you were good at the classroom. So it's not really a question of intent. There are a lot of great teachers in American higher education, and I think the vast majority of people who go into the teaching business very much want to be good at their jobs, but they're put in a difficult position. They aren't trained to be teachers. It's just a fact that in order to get a PhD, you do not have to go through any kind of, as our previous caller said, any kind of like legitimate program of teacher training or pedagogy. It's also a fact that if you want to be promoted at some place like the University of Wisconsin-Madison, research is the name of the game. The publish or perish system is still the way things work in academia. There is no teach or perish system for promotion and getting tenure at the major research universities, and it's the research universities that really provide cues to the rest of the profession and the rest of the system about the kind of values that institutions embrace.
In our last couple of minutes, Kevin, I want to look toward your vision for the future. You talk about the University of Everywhere. What 10 years from now, say you've got a 7-year-old now, what might their college experience look like in a decade?
I think that here's what's going to change. I have a 4-year-old now, so I've got a little more time to save and prepare for higher education. I think right now, if she were to go to college right now, she would have one kind of option. There's really only one kind of institution to go to, and as we've said, it was an institution that was probably designed a long time ago. 15 years from now, I think there will be three options. There will still be some traditional colleges or institutions that have the names of institutions that we now see as traditional colleges to go to. There will be some higher education organizations that exist mostly, I don't even want to say online, because I think that bespeaks a very kind of limited sense of how we're going to interact with computers in the future. It's not all going to be sitting in front of a monitor, kind of with a keyboard. Human-computer interaction is going to get much better and more fluid and more human in the future. And then there's going to be a third option, which will be having a relationship with new higher education organizations that are places where you actually leave home. Probably my daughter will want to leave home when she's 18, just like I did, just like lots of people do. You leave home, you move somewhere, you live among other students, you live among adults who are older and wiser than you, who can help mentor you and move you through college. But these are organizations that will be built from the ground up to fully take advantage both educationally and economically of all that information technology can offer.
We'll leave it there. That was Kevin Carey. His new book is The End of College.